Lorraine Lopez, welcome back to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me back. I really appreciate this.
I think the last time we talked was when your novel, The Darling, came out. When was that?
That was about 4 or 5 years ago, I'm thinking.
And is this new book, Postcards from the Jaren State, Stories, is this the book directly after that, or was there one in between?
It is the book right after that, and it came out fall 2019. Wow. So a year ago, came out a year ago.
A year already, my God. You know, yeah. It's like 2020, as horrible as it's been, it's gone by so fast that sometimes I still think I'm in 2019.
It does seem that way. Like we're having this Rumpelstiltskin experience of just, you know, shutting down and waiting for time to resume when this ends.
And did you get a chance to take the to do a book tour before the pandemic struck?
No, not at all. In fact, the book came out, I was in Europe, and I was on a research trip, and I returned just before the pandemic started.
Wow.
So I didn't, the only event I've done was the one with you at MTSU.
Wow, yeah, that was about, a month or so ago. Yeah, that's, right. Same with me, when Kafka in a Skirt came out, the pandemic started, so I haven't had much of a chance. And it's funny, you were in Europe, and had you stayed maybe a little bit longer, you might still be there in quarantine, unable to fly.
Right. Yeah, not a terrible outcome. I mean, not great, but right. It might have been interesting.
What country were you in?
Well, I was in Portugal, Spain. I'm trying to think if I went anywhere else. No, I think just Portugal and Spain.
Wow. You know, when 9/11 happened so many years ago, I was in Europe. I was in France, and I went to the airport, and they asked me if I'd be willing to stay an extra day because they had oversold the seats, and they were very kind about it. And I said, no, I just want to go home. And then 9/11 happened, and I realized I would have had to stay in Paris for like a couple of months. And I thought, wow, I should have taken that deal.
Yes, indeed. I mean, there are worse outcomes than staying in Paris a couple of months.
Yeah. But they're both tragedies. 9/11 and this pandemic, it's horrible what's happening. Yeah. And we're very, very fortunate to be able to be writers and professors and to be able to get through this, without too much personal grief, except for those people that we've lost, which, right. You know, of course, is immense, especially here in El Paso. It's horrible here in El Paso right now. My wife lost her grandfather about 3 weeks ago to COVID. He went into the hospital, not for COVID, but got it there and died there by himself in ICU. It was very sad.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
But anyway, I don't mean to bring up over. We want to talk about your book, your new collection of stories, Postcards from the Jaren State. This is what, your fifth, sixth book?
Well, it's actually my 10th.
Oh my God. Book. Has it been 10?
Yeah. Well, I'm counting the books that I've edited, and I've done three edited collections. So it's my 7th book of fiction, single authored. Book of fiction.
Starting with Soy La Avon Lady and Other Stories.
Right. That was my first book in 2002.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So I have to ask you, I've been writing for a while. You've been writing for a while. You know, why do you keep doing it? Why, you know, what is this impulse that makes you still, and I'm not even going to say want to write, because my sense is that you need to write. I mean, you have a very successful career. You're a professor, tenured at Vanderbilt University, a beautiful institution that values you very much. Why do you keep writing? Why do you do it?
Well, it is partly what you say. I need to write. It is the thing that I do that helps me order my life or impose a certain order and vision on my life. And probably the only thing that I can do is some level of, you know, expertise after practicing so many years. And it is something that I deeply enjoy doing as well. It's something that I look forward to, having days where I can feel some time to write. It is what I love to do. And the more I do it, the less I care about what happens after I've written a book. I used to be very invested in, will it sell? Like, will people read it? And now I've just become very detached from that, and I just want to write the next book.
Well, that sounds.
So I don't know if that's good or bad.
Well, that sounds incredibly liberating, though.
It is, and I'm just going from project to project and exploring what I'm interested in writing about.
Wow.
It is liberating for that.
Yeah, well, that's a good place to be, and I think it ultimately shows in the work itself, because the work, how can I put it? There's a love for writing in the work itself. There's almost a metafictional aspect to it that is incredibly subtle, but that makes a commentary on the writing. And in your new book, I'm talking specifically about this passage where these two women are talking about writing, and one of them talks about what is necessary to have characters in fiction, and she says the other character says, well, we're not characters. And this isn't fiction. And then the writer, the fiction writer, Lucinda, lifts an eyebrow, a dubious look on her face, almost as if it's winking to the audience, saying, yeah, this is a work of fiction.
Yes. And I think it's very, I don't know if it's very common, but it's very common for me to kind of think of things in terms of superimpose that the idea of fiction onto life. And it's not always a great thing to think about people as characters, but it can create empathy. I think when you, if you are thinking about them as characters, they're multifaceted.
Right.
They're not flat.
Right. And Lucinda, who is a fiction writer, in that same conversation says that that a character needs longing. A character has to long for something that they want, but that can never be attained. Can we talk a little bit about that longing, and especially in terms of your characters and your writing process?
Sure, absolutely. I think, that for me, like for Lucinda, is the first rule of fiction. And I think when stories in workshop by emerging writers fail in terms of plot, it's usually a problem of character.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually connects to establishing that longing. What is that thing that drives the person or the character? What is that thing that sets them on a trajectory toward choice and change?
Mm-hmm.
That thing that they will undergo obstacles or overcome obstacles to achieve. So that's for me, I think, and in life, one of the things that I find most interesting about people is what they want. And how longing is a paradoxical thing, that, for example, the idea of belonging and being free, you can want two things that are oppositional at the same time. You want to be part of something, but you also want to be apart from things. You want both. And that would be a good longing to pursue for a character to pursue.
Yeah.
To want the...
I'm sorry.
Oh, and I think too. I also think about how people lie to themselves, and characters will lie to themselves about what they want, thinking, "Well, I really want this. I want this relationship, mm-hmm. or I want this job," and it is exactly the thing that they don't want.
Right. And isn't that where irony comes into fiction, when a character thinks they want something or lies to themselves about wanting something when they really need is probably something quite opposite?
Right, right. Or they want to be wanting something.
Mm.
Once they achieve what they've wanted, great dismay fills the character because there's nothing more to want, and something has to go into that vacuum.
You know, I just finished reading a book by Yuval Noah Harari, his book Sapiens, and there was a line that really struck me. He says the question that we need to ask ourselves is not so much what do we want to be, but what do we want to want.
I like that idea a lot.
Yeah, and your characters, one of the things I'm incredibly impressed about in this new book, And I guess I've continually been impressed about your work in these terms, is your characters are so complex, and they clearly have, each one of them clearly has this very, very, very deep longing that can never be satisfied. But there's a lot of characters in this. You have at least, I think, a five or so main characters, all women, artists and writers. But all these women definitely have deep desire. And the character Leia at one point asks Lucinda, the fiction writer, how do you keep track of all those characters? How do you keep track of them? And I couldn't help but think of that as a question to you, Lorraine. How do you keep track of so many complex characters with so many backstories? Do you write a graph? I mean, how do you keep track of all these? You amazingly pull off five characters with such detail and such realistic characterization.
Well, thank you. I sometimes wonder if I achieve that, or if I just create this chaos on the page. But no, I don't keep track. I do keep track of numeric things like dates and ages. I do have to write that, graph that out, because numbers confuse me always. But with characters, it would be, for me, it would be like confusing your family members.
Oh, that's nice.
like thinking your brother wants what your sister wants,
right,
or your uncle is allergic to what your nephew's allergic, you know, those kinds of things. They're easy to keep straight because they are like family to me. And and I live with them, in fact, more closely than I live with my family now, my siblings say.
Mm-hmm.
So I know my characters better. And it is true that for readers as well, I've read that you know characters better than you know people, because you can never know what people are thinking, but you can read about a character's interiority.
Mm-hmm.
So we become very close to characters. And in some ways, my characters are closer to me than the people that I know, in many ways, I guess, because I know my characters' thoughts. I know what they want. I know what they mean when they're lying. And we're not always privy to that information with people that we know. But yeah, and it is kind of the way that the brain works. For example, I cannot retain a number. I cannot retain. You could tell me two numbers, and then 2 minutes later ask me what those numbers are, and I'll have no idea. But there is something about the way that my brain works that I remember narratives and I remember characters.
Wow. And you do spend a lot of time. We do spend a lot of time with these characters. We'll spend a time with them as they're sitting in a diner, or as they're taking a walk, or as they're having dinner together. And yeah, you do kind of feel like you're part, like you're participating in life with them. And that's what I really love about this book. And one of the things that really struck me is the frame of the book, for lack of a better word, but you have the first story, which is these women staying together in this summer program at the college where they teach. And it's almost, they have to be in the dorm, and the food is horrible, and they don't really have access much to the outside world, maybe an occasional night out, and it's very claustrophobic, but they're all put together. And this is an omniscient narrator. And then at the end of the book, you also have those women together again, this time at a retreat, which is supposed to be much more, you know, luxurious and desirable, but yet still there's that claustrophobic feeling, putting these women together. And then in the middle are all the stories, sometimes, you know, following the different characters. Did you plan this structure of the book, and or did it just kind of come about as you were working on it?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Thank you for asking that. I had very deliberately planned to have it be an untelling, which would be, I'm very fascinated by reverse order stories, and I just wrote one that came out in Michigan Quarterly, and I was very proud of, you know, doing this story backwards. Each section is temporally, is chronologically after or before the one that precedes it. So it goes from, say, Thanksgiving Day to the day before Thanksgiving to the day before that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the telling of it, it's an undoing. and that's what I wanted. But the problem was that the first story, the Bermbrough Surprise, provided such a good introduction to all the characters in an omniscient way that I had to start there.
Right.
But loosely speaking, it is kind of working as an untelling, but there are a lot of lapses. I couldn't quite pull it off because then when I was ordering the stories, I thought, wow, this one speaks to this one, so I need to have that there.
So you always knew it was going to be a collection of stories? There was never a time when you thought it might be a novel?
Actually, it all began with Passionate Delicacy. I changed the title so it's confusing. Passionate Delicacy was the first story that I wrote, and that appeared in Homicide Survivor's Picnic. I was always fond of that story, and I thought that I could do much more with these characters. So that's the first thing. And then I wanted to write a novella, just because I had taught a novella workshop at a graduate seminar, and it was so widely popular. And I mean, I had three people come out with books from that workshop. Yeah, it was really amazing. So I thought, well, why can't I write a novella? You know, I shouldn't be teaching this unless I'm writing. And so I wrote the novella, actually wrote it at a residency where I was going to work on The Darling, but this annoying woman kept
bothering
me.
Oh, my God. I was going to ask you about that annoying woman.
Yeah.
And so that's the last story in the book, which really is the longest story, I believe, right? I
mean, yeah, it is a novella. So, I wrote that right after Passionate Delicacy and then found I couldn't do anything with it on its own. I would need another novella to put it in a book. And I really didn't like the standalone novellas that I'd seen published too much. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, I have to write the rest of the stories.
Wow. And one of the details is that these women teach at a small women's college called Bermbrough. It's not spelled that way, but the narrator makes it clear that that's how it's pronounced. And, you know, obviously the reader's going to think about the symbol of the women's movement and burning the bras as a symbolic act. And I'm wondering what that meant to you, what it means to you. Or is it a nod, a wink? Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, I liked the irony of making up this word for this college to describe this process of refining raw material to make it into precious metal. I like that idea, which is...
Sounds like an alchemist.
Yeah.
Are you into alchemy, Lorraine?
Yeah, and that was what the founders had in mind. You know, we're going to take these raw material young women and make them into precious metal. But then they come upon this name back in the late 1800s when the school's founded that has no connection, you know, doesn't have any, wouldn't in any way be connected to the idea of burning a bra. So they were fine with calling it burn bra. Mm-hmm. And yet the women who teach there feel the irony very keenly when they see that the school is run by ancient white men who appoint as the president a terribly offensive man, makes an awful sexist comment in his speech. So they feel that irony quite keenly and resentfully. That's kind of where that idea came from. And I liked calling it burn bra and having the women have to say burn bra all the time when it is the opposite of that symbol of liberation.
I'm really interested in your process when you write, and I'm wondering, did that Burn Bra title come as you were making revisions, or did it just come out in the language on the first draft?
Initially I had called it Bunting. I wanted to call it Bunting because I wanted this idea of being like a little baby in Bunting. But then I realized, no, there is an institute, you know, that's quite well known, and I don't, you know, cast aspersions on that institution that is very, you know, respectable. So I had to cast about for another name, and that came to me in Burnborough, I guess. And I like that I changed it.
Yeah, no, I think it's fantastic. The first story is called The Burnborough Surprise, and it again takes place at this summer institute at the college where these women have just, you know, some of them just barely got jobs there and, you know, seem to be very grateful that they have a job, but the job doesn't turn out to be as prestigious as they thought it would. They thought they were going to be, you know, at an R1 institution, and it turns out that they're, you know, that there's a lot more challenges, a lot more composition classes Lucinda has to teach. And there's this ever omniscient kind of fear about your job, about their jobs, about is it going to last? Is it going to, you know, and I'm wondering, you know, who you're speaking to or who you're speaking for when you have characters that are rooted in this system that has complete, often disrespect for writers and artists and give them the worst schedules and all these surprise commitments that they didn't know that they were going to have being a professor and not even time to do their work except in that Wyoming retreat. And I wonder, yeah, who are you talking to here? Who are you, whose story are you telling?
Well, I guess it is, you know, there are elements of lived experience. One of my first jobs was in a non R1 university with a 5-4 teaching load.
Wow.
And so I knew that grind. Uh-huh. And I could see what it was doing to people, how it was so discouraging. And also experienced the low pay alongside of the anxiety about losing the job. I had seen people terminated from this job for having same-sex partners.
Wow.
So it was a very fearful, unpleasant place to be. And yet it is considered an elite profession to be a college professor. But it isn't always the case. So that was what was informing my writing of it, was my lived experience. But as to who I'm writing to, I don't really have a sense of who that would be. Mm-hmm. Maybe just readers at large who want to read a humorous, I guess I'm hoping a humorous, I had intended it as a campus comedy, and there's a great tradition of campus comedy. And I said when I set out to do this, I read a lot of campus comedies, and I love them so much.
Wow.
So I guess I'm writing to the campus comedy reader.
Right. I can't help but thinking about, you know, when I first started teaching, that was, you know, I was community college, and a lot of the experience that these women have at their college certainly resonated with me, you know, when I was in that position. It's very funny, but sad, especially when you think about the part-timers who are just want to have jobs like Lucinda has, but you know, they're treated even worse.
Right.
So when you write, I'm thinking of your character on your last book, The Darlings. She was a professor as well, I believe, or a student of literature. And then Lucinda, it could be argued that Lucinda is the anchor character in this entire collection, although it does, you know, go to, you know, tell everybody's story, really, and it belongs to everybody. But I'm wondering if there are similarities between Lucinda and I forget the name, main character of Darlings. What was
it? Caridad.
Yeah. Are there similarities between them? Are they in the voice, perhaps, or in, you know, are there, how are these characters related, if in any way at all?
Yeah, I think Caridad is not as funny as Lucinda. And in some ways, Caridad is a little more vulnerable, mm-hmm. because I see humor as a self-protective device that people use. So she's a little more trusting, I think, of people. And she, but Lucinda is armored with humor.
Yeah.
Lucinda's first reaction to anything is going to be to snort, you know, derisively. So, and I really do love Lucinda. She's one of my favorite characters. And I will tell you my next project, because I've just written, I have a book about the missions that is with my agent, and I have a book of that is a YA science fiction book. So that I'm working on. I'm finished with the full draft, revising and editing that, but I'm taking notes for my next
wow.
book, is which is titled, working title, Lucinda, and it's all about Lucinda. Lucinda's going to go to an R1 university.
Oh my God, she deserves it. She works hard.
She's going to get into lots of trouble there.
Yeah. You know, there's this, you know, talk about character depth. Lucinda, you know, is a character who we're pretty much rooting for most of the time. But then there's this complexity at the end of the book that kind of makes you and her question her own faults and her own personalities. And that just really kind of made her a lot more, real, I guess you can say.
You know what I love most about characters, whether it's in literature or film or really great TV, I love when characters are dynamic, where they change. They start out one way and they become another.
Right.
And this is what I was after and how successful with Lucinda. She's an abused woman who fears becoming abusive herself and controlling and punishing herself. And even though she fears it, it's happening to her.
Wow.
So, but she's trying, and that's what I love about her. She's trying to catch herself and correct, not always successfully. Right.
Thank you for joining us, and I wish you the best with this beautiful, beautiful book.
Well, thank you, Daniel. Thank you for this important work that you do. You're a hero of mine. This is such a great program that you do, and you're really wonderful to run it.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you.